This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. The combination of the COVID-19 pandemic, the conflict in Ukraine, and climate change impact are all contributing to the rising cost of food. And this, in turn, has rocketed food security to the top of national concerns the world over. How is the ASEAN region impacted by disruptions to the global food supply chain? And is there a way to future-proof ourselves against similar shocks moving forward? Joining me to discuss this today is Dr. Paul Teng, Professor and Adjunct Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. Paul, good morning. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Good morning, Shazana. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, I'd like to focus our conversation today on food security in the ASEAN region and how we've been impacted by both external and internal factors. Can we start with getting a picture on how ASEAN countries measure in terms of food security overall?
Okay, well, overall, ASEAN countries differ quite a bit, okay, in how food secure they are. But to really explicate that, you know, I need to explain, you know, to your listeners that food security is not just about having food available. It's also having food that's affordable. It's also safe as well, okay, and there's a stable supply of it all, yeah. So it's a multi kind of metric, you know, description of food security. Now, in this regard, if we go by some of the global, you know, kind of benchmarking indices, like the Global Food Security Index, for example, only two countries are in the top 50 of the world's most food secure countries, and that's Singapore and Malaysia in ASEAN, although Thailand comes a close third. The other ASEAN countries, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, and so on, are ranked, you know, 50 and above. And what is interesting is that, you know, when we look at their food security situation in each country, there are obvious differences. I mean, countries like Singapore, Brunei, obviously, you know, under normal times, because of the high GDP per capita, most of their households can afford to buy food, right? So their affordability rating is very high. But in terms of crisis, like the Ukraine crisis, where there's supply chain shortages, then their availability metric gets very low. But generally, we're not as food insecure as some of the countries that are seeing severe conflicts, so severe natural calamities, like those in Africa, for example. Mm. You know, we don't see the same level of insecurity as, say, exists in Yemen, South Sudan, you know, or the drought-stricken ones like Ethiopia and so on, yeah? So I think that in a nutshell, I think we're relatively food secure, although there are big differences between countries.
How useful is hunger as an indicator of how food secure a country is? So you went through a couple of different dimensions of food security, yeah? And if I look at the Global Hunger Index, most ASEAN countries fall under the moderate levels of hunger. So would this correlate with the assessment of regional food security?
Hunger is definitely one of the metrics that we use to indicate food insecurity. But hunger is an extreme example of food insecurity. In fact, there are other, you know, kind of metrics, you know, on food insecurity, you know, not just hunger, but let's say malnutrition or undernutrition, for that matter. And then on the flip side, it's actually overnutrition. We do have overnutrition issues as well in ASEAN. It's not just undernutrition, yeah? And overnutrition is also food insecurity, you know, one expression of it. So if you look at, back to hunger, though, I mean, you're absolutely right, you know, two or three of our countries in the ASEAN region do very badly in terms of hunger. And that hunger, in turn, has a submetric. And one of the submetrics is, let's say, stunting of children under 5 years old. And several of our countries here in the ASEAN region have very high percentages of children who are stunted. Yeah, to just name two of those, you know, Indonesia and Philippines. And these are well documented because of prolonged hunger, prolonged malnutrition, perhaps more prolonged malnutrition than hunger itself, yeah.
Based on what you're saying, food security is quite a complex picture, yeah, in the sense that you can find malnutrition even in the wealthier ASEAN economies. Obesity is prevalent in the wealthier ASEAN economies, and that's all part of facets of food security. And I'd like to maybe take a look at all the different factors disrupting food security at the moment. I think it's the three C's in short, yeah? And I'd like to look at how our region is specifically impacted. If we can take them in turn, starting with the COVID-19 pandemic, now that we're seeing economies reopen again and most ASEAN countries are transitioning to a COVID endemic reality, are there still lingering effects on food supply chains resulting from the pandemic specifically?
Oh, very definitely, very definitely. You know, the thing is that the world has not fully recovered from the pandemic. Right? I mean, you take China, for example. You know, China is not just an importer, but an exporter of foodstuffs, especially fresh fruits and vegetables, you know? And because the COVID situation is pretty precarious there right now, as we all know, right, they have not been able to really facilitate the trade in food from China. So yes, the lingering effects of COVID are still there, because COVID has been a facial phenomenon. Countries, you know, get it, they recover, they deal with it, and then they might get a second or third wave. So that second and third wave will also affect their food production, you know, trade activities. I think the COVID threat is still very much there. It's not totally gone yet itself, yeah? And of course, with new, you know, variants coming on board, you know, we're just not sure, really.
Right. Yeah. So for as long as we can potentially see flare-ups, it's still going to have an effect on our food supply chains. Turning to the conflict in Ukraine, which is geographically remote to the region, but would you say that the conflict in Ukraine right now is the major disruptor of food security for ASEAN at the moment?
I would say it's almost equivalent to the climate change. Okay? But definitely, the immediate effect is a yes. The Ukraine crisis has been a big disruptor because of its importance, you know, as a source of very, very major food items. Like the ones that always come to mind are wheat, you know, corn, sunflower oil, and stuff like that, you know. Some Asian countries depend almost entirely on the Russian-Ukraine region for these kind of supplies. Okay? So they really particularly feel the impact of the supply chain disruptions. And the irony is that, you know, it's actually not a shortage of wheat, right? Mm. It's the inability to export the wheat that's the issue. And I kind of mentioned wheat because Indonesia, for example, you know, Indonesia is one of the world's largest importers of wheat. So yeah, I think the Ukraine crisis, you know, is probably the crisis that is most immediately felt. Now then, and I said earlier on that, you know, climate change. Now, I worry about climate change because climate change is one of those, you know, complex of factors that expresses itself sometimes immediately, but sometimes in terms of a time lag. If, for example, take India, for example. India, you know, say was going to, you know, export wheat, and it stopped doing that because of the threat of the high temperatures in the wheat belt, right? So to be safe, you know, they started, you know, going to protectionism, right? Now, we're also seeing problems in Latin America and North America with respect to floods and droughts. Because the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, you know, are the world's biggest, you know, I would say food baskets, food and feed baskets, you know, with respect to soybean, corn, you know, and even livestock, yeah. Anything that affects their production there is going to ripple through the supply chain to impact major importers like Asia and Southeast Asia. In fact, one of the frightening stats I actually toss around is that, you know, as a region, Asia imports more than 70% of the world's soybeans. Hmm. And most of it comes from the Western Hemisphere. So you can well imagine, you know, if there's a shortage of soybean meal, for example, we're going to feel it. There's a shortage of feed for our poultry and so on. And so prices are going to go up, which is what I think what happened in Malaysia recently. Basically, the supply disruptions, you know, of animal feed and with the concomitant rise in prices. So that then puts a lot of real growers out of business because it's so challenging. Together with COVID, you know, labor increases and then fuel price increases, and they're all kind of compounding the situation. You know, in fact, one of my colleagues, you know, said that we're actually seeing a perfect storm right now occurring. All these factors, yeah.
And I suppose climate change is that looming monster on the horizon, yeah. So what's your assessment of how governments in ASEAN are viewing these climate change risks? Do you think that they are cognizant enough of the risks? Or perhaps are they turning a blind eye to what is arguably what feels like a long-term problem in the face of all these short-term challenges right now?
I would say that yes, generally awareness is very high now amongst ASEAN countries, but in terms of measures to actually deal with climate change, now that varies quite a bit amongst ASEAN countries. Okay? I give an example of the Philippines. Even though the Philippines economically is not as strong, they in fact have in place some amazing plans to deal with climate change, especially for their major food crop like rice, for example, right? And one of the key centers of rice expertise, the International Rice Research Institute, what happens to be based in the Philippines. And they're a source of very valuable, what we call climate adaptation technologies, okay, which many other countries benefit from. Yeah? So countries are now putting in place not just mitigation, but also adaptation measures as far as food security is concerned. The one that always comes to mind, again, I use rice as an example, you know, say dealing with a flash flood, for example, right? Some of the rice breeders have come up with the rice varieties that can remain submerged, you know, when there's flash flooding for up to 15 days. And when the water goes away, the rice will re-emerge and put out, you know, the same, if not even higher crop than before. Then they also like moves by at international level to coordinate efforts at establishing what they call climate smart villages. I mean, Vietnam is kind of in the forefront in this area, yeah, because of the organization of the agriculture system there. You know? So there are a lot of things like this happening, both coordinated across countries, also at the country level.
I see.
Yeah? Now, having said that, you know, of course, because ASEAN, you know, it's not like the EU, right? You know, ASEAN cannot mandate action amongst its member states. We're almost like a big club, right? We do what we want. We listen to advice, right? So then the implementation of the advice varies so much, depending on government priorities and also government abilities, especially financial abilities. Huh? But yes, I think the short answer to your question is yes, a lot of awareness at the moment. And I need to actually digress 1 minute here. To me, you know, I view climate change with two views. One is a longer-term view, which I think you're alluding to, the 1.5 degrees or higher temperature change, you know. Now, the other is kind of the immediate, what I call the symptoms of climate change. Okay, these are things like, you know, delayed monsoons, droughts, you know, the intensity of rainfall, okay, too much rain, also too little rain, stuff like that, and they're occurring at the wrong time. So I think in the ASEAN region, we're probably suffering much more from these immediate effects of the symptoms of climate change, rather than the long term,
right?
You know, kind of a temperature rise and so on.
So it's happening already, essentially.
Oh, it already is happening, very much so. In fact, the future is now, basically, I think, as far as climate change is concerned. And the other interesting about regional food security is that when one country suffers, the others will be affected as well. For example, in the Philippines, you know, doesn't produce enough rice because of typhoons, they go into the market to buy rice. Right. This then affects all the other countries that need to import rice. You know, and there's only a limited volume of rice available on the world market. In fact, it's what we call the thinnest traded commodity amongst the major commodities like wheat, corn. Right? Only about 7% or even sometimes less, you know, of rice that's produced is traded. So anytime there's an upsetting of production, and other countries needing to go into the market to buy, there's severe competition to buy rice, prices then hike. So again, back to the point, it's a pretty complicated, you know.
It is. And it just shows how intertwined all the region is in terms of food supplies. I'm speaking to Dr. Paul Tang, professor and adjunct senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. When we come back, is globalization the cause of our present food security woes? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying tuned to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and today I'm discussing ASEAN food security with Dr. Paul Tang, professor and adjunct senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. Paul, the globalization phenomenon has been coming under scrutiny in the wake of the food security crisis we're experiencing at the moment. And I mean, globalization is credited with reducing global hunger and famine, as well as increasing food security overall, just making, I guess, more food accessible to more parts of the world. But we're also caught in the present situation of supply chain disruptions because our global food supply chains have become longer or more consolidated to particular countries. So do you think that globalization is to blame for the predicament that we're in? Were there weaknesses that we just didn't see or ignore?
Well, I wouldn't say to blame, but certainly I think globalization is one of the reasons why our supply chains have become so interconnected. Because as we all know, I think, you know, globalization has allowed us, you know, to basically up the living standards that we all want, what aspire to, right? And in the case of food, you know, I mean, no country has been able to produce all the food items that it wants in response to growing economic development. Okay, because one of the outcomes of, you know, increasing GDP, households want a more diverse diet. And here, in Singapore, you know, we're actually very guilty. We want to eat lobsters from Maine, which is far away, you know. And that's because, you know, it's not just because, you know, it's a status thing, but of course, I mean, generally, they've got nice lobsters from there, right? So, yeah, I think because of globalization, supply chains have become longer, you're right there. But they've also become interconnected. And of course, the next question is, can we do without globalization? Personally, I don't think so. Okay. You know, as far as food is concerned, because again, you know, if you look back, you know, as economies develop, you know, it really doesn't make sense for countries which don't have the competitive advantage to produce certain food items to continue producing that, right? And let me go back to rice as an example. Okay. It's actually 3 or 4 times more expensive in the Philippines to grow 1 kilo of rice than it is in Thailand and Vietnam. Right? So if I were a national planner, I would say, look, you know, why should I use my scarce water, scarce land, scarce labor to grow rice when under normal circumstances, Vietnam and Thailand would love to export their rice, right? So these are all economic arguments here. And it's not just rice, it's any other product that you can think of. You know, which is why, I mean, in some respects, I think the world has become interlinked because of that. Right, you know, I mean, China's that can produce, you know, countries like China that can produce more cheaply, then they become almost like the factory of the world, right? Yeah, but this, again, this phenomenon will not last. I mean, if you talk to economists, you know, I mean, they are very phasal, aren't they? Right, as economies develop, cost of labor gets higher, and then there's also what we call structural transformation of economies. You know, I mean, that is another big factor because most countries that develop nationally, economically, tend to restructure their economies from rural to urban.
In terms of forces of economic development, yeah, and how that has shaped agricultural sectors in ASEAN, as you said, the typical trajectory from developing to developed economy is seen as the progress from an agrarian society to an industrialized one. Is this what's impacting ASEAN's agricultural sector? And could that be, I guess, one of the factors why we are less self-sufficient than we'd perhaps want to be in these kinds of situations? Okay.
I would kind of look at it this way. I think it's a real watch out for us in ASEAN. Because whether we like it or not, over the last few decades, okay, the employment in agriculture has been declining in almost every ASEAN country. Okay? The contribution of agriculture, value addedness, the national GDP has also been declining. At the same time, urbanization has been increasing in the ASEAN region. Okay? So, you know, again, it's back to a set of interlinked factors here, right? Now, except for Malaysia, to some extent Indonesia, I think, where, you know, the growing of your plantation crops, like it's not under agriculture because it's not food, right? It's under your trade industry because they're basically, you know, industrial crops, right? Now, in other countries that don't have as high, you know, a percentage of their land area under perennial industrial crops, their agriculture policies focus a lot on food. The big countries like Indonesia, you know, and also Philippines. Now, to them, food agriculture is very important. Okay? So even though overall, you know, employment has gone down in agriculture, agriculture's contribution has gone down, there's still substantial numbers of people who live in the countryside who have to eat. And then you balance that then with the increasing number of people in the urban areas. Right, so net-net, you see a decline in the farming population, you know, and there's also another related problem which I should mention, which is the challenge of getting young people back into farming. It's a problem that every country, in fact, faces in the ASEAN region. and also beyond. Yeah, and this is again very interesting, you know, where the ASEAN ministers, in fact, have gotten together just recently to ask the question, how do we incentivize a younger generation to get into farming? And one interesting proposal is digital agriculture, digitalization. Yeah, I mean, just for your listeners, in fact, the ASEAN ministers have gotten together and endorsed a code, you know, for investing in digital agriculture in all of ASEAN. How do we do it? As a means not just to attract a younger generation back in agriculture, but also to increase productivity.
The point is, I suppose you see that there are opportunities to revitalize the agricultural sector through digitalization. Do you think that when it comes to strengthening the agricultural sector, the government needs to get involved? Because at this point, based on comparative advantage, based on how things are at the moment, agriculture isn't really a money-making industry for many businesses. Is this where government needs to come in, do you think?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I've analyzed many countries, and the policy imperative is one that belongs to the government. And the policy imperative is the most important. Okay? Policies, for example, you know, to incentivize the private sector to invest, policies to incentivize farmers to grow more, right? And also policies, you know, that can incentivize consumers to be a bit more rational in the demand for food. Yeah. So policy is very key, because having the right policy framework then enables proper regulations to be set, you know, proper guidelines and so on, and basically lays the playing field for the private sector to get in, for consumer associations to get in, and so on, actually. So to me, policy is very key. That's where governments play a role. But having said that, my view too is that, and this might sound very radical, you know, I think policies can be set by the government, and after that, I think they should get out of the way and let other players get in that are more efficient, especially the private sector. And I mean, we've seen that in other sectors, you know, like financing, you know, like the phone industry, you know, where the major advances are in fact made in the private sector. But the policies have to be there. Now, the one role that governments can play is really in terms of investing in infrastructure. Now, we saw that in the 50s and 60s, you know, where even countries like Malaysia, right, there was a lot of investment in infrastructure, for example, in the Mada area, Kada area, to enable paddy farmers to grow with the irrigation systems and so on. So it's not that governments don't have a role. They do have a role, but we've got to be very clear about their role. And definitely, they should not be an impediment to investments and action by the private sector. I think that is very key, yeah.
It's curious, though, when it comes to agriculture, there seems to be that emotive factor involved, yeah, that leads to governments being more protectionist about agriculture than they are about other areas, that they don't allow market forces to come in and do their thing. I mean, what do you make of that kind of dilemma there?
Okay, so it is a real dilemma. But the dilemma stems from the fact that, you know, food, right? Food is existential need. And food also becomes a political, you know, tool. Many cases, you know. So when you put all this together, you can understand why governments are so wary anytime food sources, food production, food supplies are threatened. And also whether we like it or not, in some Asian countries, also ASEAN countries, the rural bloc is a very important voting bloc for many governments.
Final question, Paul. I would be curious about how concerned you are about political instability in the region arising from persisting food insecurity. This may be outside your scope of agricultural research. It's more into the political science of things. But I'm just wondering whether you foresee the situation in ASEAN possibly becoming as dire as what happened during the Arab Spring, for example, where protests stemmed from the high cost of food. What's your gauge of the temperature?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think that politically, were more stable than many of the countries, you know, in the Middle East and North Africa. You know, I think governments have measures that enable them to either buy more food, release from stockpiles, yeah, or even draw, like in the case of rice again, draw from emergency stockpiles that at the ASEAN level that exist and so on, you know. So I don't see the level of civil disobedience that we have seen, you know, let's say during the 2007-2008 crisis, right? I mean, when there were over 40-something countries, you know, where we saw actually food riots, yeah? Now, we saw probably a couple, you know, small ones here in the ASEAN region. That's about it. And I expect it to continue. Now, in fact, my bigger worry, actually, in fact, is in terms of climate change, you know, something that we can't control at all, you know, going forward. especially like I mentioned earlier, the symptoms of climate change, because we're so susceptible, and it's something we just can't predict what's going to happen, and that's going to perhaps even cause more misery to our citizens, yeah? So much so that they can't even afford to go out and protest,
okay? Right.
For lack of food.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Well, on that rather somber note, Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me and sharing all your insights on this really fascinating and complex issue.
You're most welcome, Jana.
I've been speaking to Dr. Paul Tang, Professor and Adjunct Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.